me out after this. Okay. You don't understand.
All right. We're not going to stop over
that. Hey, guys, the most important thing you have to know is that the two requirements are the same for the rest of the day. The most important thing is,
not here. 6 o'clock, right? Not a minute later. 6 o'clock, we gotta all be back in on the campus. We're gonna have some food, some potato kugels, some arugula, some stuff like that, and then we're heading out onto a bus. So 6 o'clock, you gotta come all ready for Shabbos, shower, a little bit nicer clothes. We're heading out. We're taking the bus to the hotel. If you miss that bus, you're gonna miss everything, and we cannot even be a second late on that bus because we got time. We're chasing the clock because Shabbat is coming in. So 6 o'clock here, 6:30, we're out. Cool? Okay, and there's also good food because we're not going to eat dinner tonight until like 10 o'clock. So, might as well come and get some food.
We might be hungry.
Okay, good morning, everybody. And I guess for a lot of you guys, this will be your maybe first Shabbos in Israel or first Shabbos in Jerusalem. Certainly the first Shabbos of this program. And it really is a very, very special idea. You know, there's a Kabbalistic work that is called Sefer Yetzira, and that's the Book of Creation. And the work itself is very esoteric, and I cannot claim to fully understand it either. But it deals with the idea that God created the universe through the spiritual DNA of the alphabet, meaning there's something about the Hebrew language that's very unique. And that is, there is a spiritual power in each of the letters, and when God combines the letters in a certain way, there is creative energy that is released, just like actual DNA. We represent it by letters, sequences of letters. So, for example, when we say, you know, there's an old saying, but Mark Twain once wrote an essay, he was a bit sarcastic, and he portrays Adam naming the animals in the Garden of Eden. And his wife asks him, why did you call that animal a lion? And Adam says, well, it looks like a lion, so I called it a lion. Well, obviously that's ludicrous because he called it a lion, or he didn't know whatever the Hebrew word is. But in Hebrew that actually makes sense, because the word for lion is aryeh, and in ways that I cannot really explain to you, the arrangement of Aleph, Resh, Yud, He represents the spiritual energy out of which that lion came. So a Hebrew name is an example of reverse engineering. You actually look into the guts of something, and it's that combination of letters that represents the soul. Well, that was just a digression. The only reason I mentioned Sefer Yetzira is that Sefer Yetzira talks about reality as the intersection of three planes of existence. And that is Adam, person, Shana, time, and place. So there's time, place, and the human being that is interacting or intersecting with time and place, right? And that's really the definition of our existence. We exist as finite beings within the plane of time-space. Now, the reason that's important is that, in a sense, you are at a very fortuitous intersection, because you are in the holiest place of the world. I don't mean Or Sameach per se, but you know, Jerusalem, the Kotel, and the like, the Western Wall. You are approaching the holiest day in time, which is the Shabbat, and you bring your human personality into that intersection of time and place. And essentially, the Sefer Yetzirah talks about the fusion of time, place, and human identity into a harmonious whole. I know that sounds a bit abstract, but Shabbat is indeed a very, very special time. It's a special time in Wisconsin, and it's a special time in North Dakota, but it's even more special here in Jerusalem. And just again, pardon me for the digressions as I talk. I think of different points, which are not necessarily the main topic, but I think they're worthwhile. And that is, sometimes there's a bit of a problem that Judaism, you know, we have a concept, certain places are holier than others. I would say Israel is holier than some other place, and Jerusalem is holier than the rest of Israel, and the Temple Mount is holier than the rest of Jerusalem. And we say, because God is there. Now, there is a bit of a problem here. I mean, we don't believe God is fixed on a certain location. God is everywhere. In fact, I think I mentioned the other day that the rabbinic term for God is makom, which means the place, because essentially, as the Talmud explains, God is not located in the universe. The universe is located in God. God is the location of everything. So at first glance, it might seem a little perplexing that we talk about certain places being more spiritual than other places, given the fact that God is everywhere, and God is not limited to a particular place. The same question could be raised about certain days. Why are certain days, what does it mean certain days are holier than other days, if after all, God is here all the time? And the way to look at it is this. God is equally here and equally there and equally everywhere. God is not limited to any particular place. But our capacity to receive Him depends on the environment that we're in, like a cell phone, right? They're all over the place. There are going to be sound waves and electrical impulses. But there'll be areas where you'll be able to receive them, whether it's a radio or a cell phone. And then there'll be areas of dead reception. That doesn't change the fact that there are these waves all over the place, but you need a certain capacity to receive. So when we talk about certain places being holier than other places, when we talk about certain days being holier than other days, we're not talking about, you know, God is more or less in a given place, but we are talking about our capacity to open up and receive godliness. And that is enhanced by certain places. Certain places, what is the old joke? They say that it's good to daven in Israel, to pray in Israel, because here it's a local call. Anywhere else is kind of a long distance call. Meaning there's a concept that you pray in New York, so your prayer, again this is just a metaphor, your prayer has to cross the Mediterranean until it reaches Jerusalem and then it goes up. So it'll get there, but you know, it's kind of a trip, a little expensive. You do it here, it's a direct local call and the like. So we're not talking about God so much as we're talking about our capacity to receive godliness. And that is enhanced by the time-space continuum in which where you are, the particular place that you are, the experiences that you have, the days of the week, Shabbat, and the like. And this is the meaning of a very interesting Talmudic teaching. The Talmud says that when Shabbat comes in, every one of us gets what is called an extra soul. Or I would actually translate it, not an extra soul, but an enlarged soul, an enhanced soul. Rashi actually says, that is why you eat more on Shabbat, because you're eating for two. Now that sounds like a bit of a trivialization, that the purpose of an extra soul is I could eat more. And of course, when the soul leaves at the end of Shabbat, it does not take the calories with it, unfortunately. But it is said that, you know, have you ever, I'm sure you've seen it over the years, have you ever participated in the ceremony after Shabbat, the Havdalah ceremony? You know, we welcome the Shabbat with Kiddush, we sanctify the Shabbat, and then as we leave Shabbat, we escort it with a ceremony called Havdalah. I remember when I was a little child and I first heard the word Havdalah in the synagogue, I thought it was half dollar. I couldn't figure out. See, I made a very ingenious, I'm going to boast about myself a little bit. You know, I actually came from a non-religious family, but as a young child, people took an interest in me and I went to synagogue. So I remember the Torah reading, and then there's something after the Torah reading that's called Haftorah. But I had never heard the word Haftorah before. So I was trying to figure out what it was. Now the Haftorah means after we read the Torah, we read the book of the prophets that's connected. So I reasoned, as only a 9 or 10 year old can do, well, since the prophets are less important than the Torah, so Haftorah probably means half Torah. Now you got Torah, and then you get half Torah. I thought that made a lot of sense. But when I got to Havdalah, that stumped me. I couldn't figure out what was Havdalah. Okay, so that theory had to go out the window until I found out exactly what it was. But be it as it may, as part of the Havdalah, Havdalah means, like, the word Kiddush means sanctification. And Havdalah means separation, because we're separating between the holy and the profane. Right? It's a very, very beautiful ceremony. And you will notice, though, that one of the things we do with Havdalah and the Havdalah ceremony is we take aromatic spices and we inhale them. Now, what is the purpose of that? So the commentaries say Because since when Shabbat is over, on Shabbat you had an extra soul or an enhanced soul. And after Shabbat you lose that soul because you're going back to the work week. So you feel weak, you feel woozy, you feel dizzy, you feel that you've lost something. So just like when somebody faints, they take smelling salts to kind of revive them. So we need to be revived because we're losing the extra soul. And that is why the Havdalah, although, you know, it is joyous because we're celebrating, not the end of Shabbat, not really, but you're celebrating the Shabbat that you just had. It's like saying goodbye to a beautiful and honored guest. But there is sadness, and there should rightfully be a certain amount of sadness, because this wonderful experience is now leaving. But the good news is it's going to be back, right? That's the great point about Judaism. It says that you're never really too far away from Shabbat, because Sunday, Monday, Tuesday is living in the afterglow of the Shabbat. It kind of still stays with you. Now, by Tuesday night, it's gone. But Wednesday, Thursday, Friday is living off the Shabbat that's coming. So you're never too far, because the first 3 days of the week, you're connected to the old Shabbat. And the latter part of the week, you're connected to the new Shabbat. It's as if you look at Shabbat as the middle of the week instead of the end of the week. So you have Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Shabbat, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Shabbat. Right? Look at it as the pinnacle of a mountain. You're going up, and then you're going down from the mountain. But there is that concept of sadness, that indeed, I'm leaving the Shabbat. That's why you'll notice that even the songs that we sing, again, not everyone is sophisticated with the nuances of Jewish music, but if you study even Jewish music carefully, you will notice that the songs that we sing on the third meal, Shabbat has three meals, a Friday night meal, a Shabbat morning lunch, and then what is called the third meal, which is usually relatively modest. But, you know, we have a third meal because we honor the Shabbat with three meals in which we recite Birkat HaMazon for each of those meals. But you may notice, now again, not everybody is aware of this, so you may not notice at every single synagogue or every single place, but the songs that are sung at the third meal are sometimes sad, yearning songs. In other words, they're not the rah-rah-rah types of tunes, although Nor Samachli sometimes do that. But the traditional mood of Suda Shlishit is a somber yearning, as if, you know, you're with your lover for the last time, at least until next week. And when you're saying goodbye, there's a certain sense of longing. When are we going to be together again? And that's why there's a certain mood, right? Some of the meals of Shabbat are happy and joyous and gay, and some are more somber and reflective and yearning and pining, right? And that reflects the mood as the Shabbos ebbs away, and that reflects the idea that we're losing that connection with God. That's again something to think about. We all take I include myself. I'm not here to lecture you in any way. You know, even people who keep Shabbat, who've been Orthodox, been religious for many, many, many years, we take it for granted. We really don't realize what a precious gift it is. And indeed, I want to say, perhaps, you know, guys like you can teach us, because for some of you at least, I don't know, Shabbat might be a new experience. And in the very vibrancy of its newness, you can see certain things in it that old-timers might not be able to notice, because we kind of, you know, we're used to it, so to speak. But it truly is a wonderful, wonderful experience. But it doesn't happen by itself. There's an old Talmudic saying, which on one level is very practical, but it's also spiritual. It says, it sounds like one of those haikus, "He who cooks on Friday will have food on Shabbos." Because you can't cook on Shabbos, right? So if you don't make any food on Friday, you'll have nothing to eat. Well, that's a bit of practical advice. You know, you better either buy your food or cook your food before Shabbat, or you're not going to have anything to eat. But it also refers to a more spiritual dimension. And that is, eating and drinking is sometimes a metaphor for what we call soul food. And by soul food, I don't mean collard greens and fried chicken. But I'm referring to that which nurtures your spiritual essence. That's what nurtures your soul. That's also called eating. So it basically says, if you want to eat on Shabbat, you want your soul to really enjoy and appreciate Shabbat, you got to do some advanced preparation from Friday or earlier than that. You can't just waltz into Shabbat and it's going to hit you like a ton of bricks. There is the notion of that's why we need Shabbat here. There is the notion of, you know, meditation, thinking, studying, learning about the Shabbat. Spiritual experiences can come to you like an epiphany. I'm not denying that that happens a lot. You know, a person is at the Western Wall and all of a sudden, you know, their life changes. That can certainly happen. But generally speaking, the most meaningful experiences are when we prepare for them, when we think about them. When one who prepares on Erev Shabbat is simply Friday, will be able to enjoy the Shabbat. You know, one of the books of the Bible is the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. And the Song of Songs is attributed to King Solomon, who's the wisest of all people. But you know that the Song of Songs almost didn't make the Bible. It almost got cut, got kind of banned in Boston. The Jewish censors, I'm talking about in the Talmud, weren't sure about including the Song of Songs. What's wrong with the Song of Songs? Because frankly, and this will probably encourage you to read it, the Song of Songs is quite a racy book of the Bible. It's explicitly sexual in its imagery. It talks about passionate relations, including even intercourse at various verses between a man and a woman. It talks about like the Romeo and Juliet types of themes of unrequited love in which the lovers are not able to get together, and every time the man is looking for the woman, she's playing hard to get. He's knocking at her door and she says, "I'm sorry, I've gone to bed for the night, come back later." And then when she realizes he's not pursuing her, she goes out looking for him and he's not around anymore. And then people are beating her and hitting her and saying, "Don't you dare go to him, you know, he's not for you." It really describes, you know, romance and love and the turbulence and passion. So there were rabbis who actually said, "Hey, this is not a biblical book. This is not a holy book. This belongs, you know, in romantic literature. Don't put it in the Bible." And yet, the great sage Rabbi Akiva got it in. He was the advocate for the Song of Songs, and it's in the Bible. And Rabbi Akiva said, "If all of the songs of the Bible are holy, the Song of Songs is the holiest of holy. And we put it in the Bible." What was Rabbi Akiva's insight? Rabbi Akiva's insight was that the Song of Songs is a metaphor for something higher and more noble than even romantic love. And that is, it is a metaphor of a passionate relationship that God has with the Jewish people. And seen in that way, the woman, the princess, who is trapped in her home, is the Jewish people in the exile. And the king, or the prince, again, it's even difficult to figure out who the character is, because there is a king, there is a prince, there is a shepherd. Is that the same person or a different person? Without getting into a whole detailed interpretation, it is God. And all of their near misses refer to, you know, when God wants to redeem us, we're not ready. When we're ready for redemption, God is not ready. And it talks about that union. And that is why it is suffused with passion and romantic love and deep caring. Going back to our relationship talk. Because that is not only a characteristic of human relationships, which of course it is and it must be, but it is a characteristic of God's relationship to the Jewish people and our relationship to God. And indeed, it's been well said that the whole paradigm of human relationships is nothing more, well, you're familiar with the Platonic idea that physical reality is really a representation of abstract spiritual ideals. Right? This is called Platonism, but it's actually rooted in Kabbalah. That Kabbalah is a form of Neoplatonism. Although it's not Neo, it's actually before Plato. And the concept is, human love is the physical representation of a higher abstract love, which is the love that God has for us and that our souls have for God. In fact, strikingly, the Vilna Gaon says, all true love is love of the divine. Listen to this interesting idea. If I love a human being, And this love is more than animal passion, which is not really love. I mean, I'm sexually attracted, that's fine. But if I truly love a human being, what do I love about them? I could love their kindness. I could love their intelligence. I can love their wit. I can love their compassion. I can love their industriousness. Those are divine qualities. We are made in the image of God. And those qualities are the qualities of God that are imprinted in our soul. So what is it that I love about another human being? I love the qualities that mirror the qualities of God. So all human love, if it is more than infatuation or self-gratification, is ultimately love of the divinity that I perceive in another person, which in turn is only a mirror of God, God Himself. Amazing, amazing idea. That you love a person to the degree that you see the godliness that is within them. And I would also add, you love yourself to that same degree. You know, it's a famous thought. The Bible says, you shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. The New Testament attributes that to Jesus, but it happens to be in Leviticus, so Jesus ripped it off. That same verse, love your neighbor yourself, is in the Torah directly. Although Jesus said it too, much later. But you know, there's an old thought, it's a famous thought, that since it says love your neighbor as you love yourself, you have to love yourself. You have to love, because if I hate myself, let's say I have self-loathing, so I'm going to love you the way I love myself, that's not going to work out too well. Because I'll treat you like the same dirt that I treat myself. So there's also self-love. That's not narcissism, but it's the same idea. I love you or someone because I sense the godliness within them, and I can love myself for the same reason, to see my godly qualities. That's not arrogance. That's simply seeing, as the t-shirt says, and I may have told you that I like t-shirt sayings because they're almost always true. When I don't feel like learning, I'll go to a t-shirt store and just read the statements. It says, God does not make junk. You must have seen that around. I see teenagers in the States wearing this thing. God doesn't make junk. That's a very, very true statement. So, basically, Shir HaShirim, and I digress for a moment. I'll get back to why this is relevant to Shabbat that we were talking about. Shir HaShirim is not only the story of Romeo and Juliet and romance. Shir HaShirim is about the depth and the intensity of passionate divine love. Now, I'm going to admit that not all of us walk around like love struck with passion for God. That's a very rare quality, to be sure. But it is something that is described. Maimonides, and many people think Maimonides was the supreme rationalist, which he was. Maimonides was a philosopher of incalculable depth. Maimonides valued the life of the mind above almost everything. Maimonides certainly lived in the world of thoughts, in the world of reason. Maimonides was even a great admirer of Aristotle. And Maimonides tried to reconcile Aristotelian philosophy, which was the philosophy of the Middle Ages, with Judaism. That's why he wrote The Guide to the Perplexed. That's what The Guide to the Perplexed is about. It is an attempt to have a philosophical synthesis of Aristotelian philosophy and Judaism. So Maimonides was not a bleeding heart, sentimental person. But Maimonides describes love of God, what it means to love God. He describes it that you are literally crazy with your passion for God. That you think about God, he says, the way a person is love struck with a woman that he can't get his mind off her. He actually, it's a bit racy for Maimonides, but he actually says that. And he uses the word meshuga, crazy, God obsessed. This is what Shir HaShirim is. Now, what does that have to do with Shabbat? Many, many people, particularly Hasidim, before they enter Shabbat, they read the Song of Songs. They read the Shir HaShirim. They try to experience that Shir HaShirim and the like. Because on Shabbat, there actually is that minuet, that is that connection to God that is there. And that is why, in a sense, we have a bit of a conflicting imagery. Because on one hand, we describe the Shabbat as the bride and we are the groom. But then we describe God as the groom and we are the bride. So we're kind of androgynous here. We kind of switch the male-female. We are the male vis-a-vis the Shabbat and we become the female vis-a-vis the Almighty. And there is this wedding that takes place every Shabbat. So there's something very powerful here that I think most of us take for granted. And as I said, I include even those of us who have kept Shabbat for many, many years. But I hope that you'll have a sense of its power and a sense of its potential. And although I would have to say that, you know, you'll never have a Shabbat like you have in Jerusalem, but, you know, when you go back to Oshkosh or Los Angeles or Madison, Wisconsin, or New Mexico or Phoenix or New York, you'll take some of this with you and try to incorporate Shabbat into your life. Try to incorporate it. Now, if you can do it 100%, you know, that's great. But one thing you got to understand is that although obviously 100% is best, but Voltaire once remarked that the enemy of the better is the best. And think about that. That's a smart remark. Because what Voltaire is saying is that sometimes we have a vision in our mind that if I can't do something perfectly, I'm not going to bother to do it at all. The enemy of the better, the enemy of my being better is I can't be the best, so why bother? And that's a big mistake. That's a big mistake in every area of life. The person who says, I don't want to take guitar lessons because I'm not going to be perfect, is losing out on something that can be very enjoyable. Well, okay, that's very good. Yeah, wow. Wow, I'm glad that must have inspired me. As I say, I get inspired by t-shirts. So that was it. Yeah. So, wow, that's amazing. So, these things happen in Israel all the time. So that's always the case. In other words, you know, there's a saying in English, anything worth doing is worth doing well. You can reverse it. Anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. Meaning to say, if it's something good, go ahead and do it, even if you're not going to be great, because it'll be better than not doing it. So Shabbat is very much the same idea. 100%, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. But if you're not ready to give up going to the movies or going to the beach, okay, it's not for me to give you a lecture. We are people of free will and we have to make our own decisions in life. But that doesn't mean you can't say Kiddush before you go to the beach. It doesn't mean you can't read a little bit of the Parsha of the week and study. Right? It doesn't mean you can't make the Hamotzi and say Birkat HaMazon. And that's not being a hypocrite. People say, oh, I'm being a hypocrite. What's the point of my having Shabbat meal and singing the songs and I'm going to desecrate the Shabbat? You're not being a hypocrite. You're trying to do as much as you're able to do at that point in your life. And that is better than not doing that. Okay, now maybe this is an obvious lesson, but it's a lesson that we need to hear. And that is, incorporate this into your life. And try to find other people that you can do it with. You can do Shabbat by yourself if you have to. And you might find that very rewarding, that you have the courage of, you know, doing it all alone. But it's very, 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 very hard. Find, hopefully, a community. But if not, even another person that you can share this with. And then it becomes something that will connect you to that other person, connect you to the Jewish people, connect you to the Shabbat, connect you to God. So, like everything else, the purpose of your trip here in Israel is not simply to have fun for 2 weeks, and it's not even simply to be spiritual for 2 weeks, but it's to give you something that you can take back with you when you go back into those environments that might be less spiritual than Jerusalem. Certainly, but you know, you'll take something along with you and you can spread the flame. You know, this is Shabbat can be very contagious. It's an amazing thing. You know, we live in a world in which we're constantly connected through technology. You know, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Instagram. You know, frankly, I'm not necessarily interested in, you know, these different postings. 1201 had a bite of my hamburger, 1202 took a Coke. You know, these postings are not really that illuminating and not that meaningful most of the time. But what we've done is we've created a virtual reality that kind of supersedes our actual reality. And people are literally addicted to these things. In fact, I will tell you that there's even people who are technically Shomer Shabbat, kids. And they're so addicted that it's called half Shabbos. It's a limited phenomenon in New Jersey. They keep all of Shabbat except they do text messaging because they can't stop. Well, that sounds pretty peculiar. I knew in my day heavy smokers, great rabbis who were heavy smokers. I'm not advising smoking. And when it came to Shabbat, they did stop. So, you know, if you care enough, you can stop. But be as it may, some of these textures can't stop. So what is Shabbat about? Shabbat is about shutting off the iPhone, getting off the internet, not checking Twitter every 5 minutes, and instead of connecting to things in an electronic way, you gotta look at the person next to you in the eye. Instead of virtual communities, you focus on actual communities. You learn to love your neighbor. You learn to think about yourself. You learn something about silence a little bit. Now, we're so afraid to be alone with our thoughts that we have to have this constant stimulation. Do you know, I don't know if you experienced this in your colleges, you know, for many, many years already, colleges were requiring of every incoming student that they have a laptop with the potential for an internet connection. Right? You needed it. But there is now a counter response. It's still a minority, but it's happening, where some schools are actually banning laptops in the classroom. I don't know if anyone has that experience. But they're claiming that a number of things, laptops or whatever it is now, it's iPhones, whatever it might be, is too distracting. Number one, people are surfing the net, people are playing solitaire or battleship or whatever it is. But number two, even the process of just typing these notes incessantly is preventing discussion, preventing thinking about. So there's actually, you might call them Luddite schools, you know, pre-technology schools, Stone Age schools, that are going back to banning computers because they want there to be more live interaction. There actually is at least a limited phenomenon that is taking place. So Shabbat is really that opportunity to escape the virtual reality and kind of re-engage with actual reality. And in that sense, you might find it a very, very unique experience, that not to be able to check Twitter, you know, every 2 minutes or whatever it is. Okay, so now let me give you a little background. You know, Shabbat, of course, is one of the commandments that is mentioned in the Ten Commandments. And you know that in the Ten Commandments appear twice in the Torah with some variations. The Ten Commandments appear in Exodus chapter 20. And they appear in Deuteronomy chapter 4. And because Deuteronomy is about Moses reviewing the Torah, so he goes over what he had already done. But what's interesting is that although the versions of the Ten Commandments are almost the same, there are some significant differences between them. So there's kind of version 1 and version 2, and they're both in the Torah. Now, Shabbat is the fourth of the Ten Commandments. And one of the major differences is how the fourth commandment begins. In Exodus, it begins, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." In Hebrew, the word for remember is zachor. In Deuteronomy, it says, "Observe or keep or safeguard the day of Shabbat, to keep it holy." The Hebrew word for that is shamor. They rhyme. Zachor, shamor. We'll discuss in a moment what the differences are, but the question is, which did God say? Did God say zachor, or did God say shamor? The Ten Commandments come from God. So the Talmud, in the typical way that we like to include everything, says, oh, God said them both simultaneously. God said Shamor and Zachor at the same time, which of course is impossible for a human being to do, but the God managed it. That's exactly right. And that's why we're going to sing Friday night, Shamor v'Zachor, The Dibur Echad were said with one word. Okay? This is reconciling Exodus and Deuteronomy. Okay, that's fine. What is the difference between remembering the Shabbat and observing the Shabbat, Zachar and Shamar? So again, a lot of this is we know from the Talmud, meaning the Torah gives you the words, but the Torah does not define the words. So we have traditions and teachings that give us the nuances. Yeah.
So on the tablets, what did it say, Zachar and Shamar?
Yeah, that is a very, very excellent question. Some have suggested that there were two tablets, right? Moses broke the first, so maybe on one tablet it was Zachar, one was Shamar. Others say that perhaps visually there was a simultaneity, meaning you look at the word, it's Zachor, then it morphs into Shamor, then it goes back to Zachor, right? That visually there was that change. So every word is a distinct meaning. There are no synonyms, so to speak. So here is what our sages tell us, the two aspects of Shabbat. Zachor, remembering the Shabbat, is what we might call the positive aspects of Shabbat. To honor the Shabbat with the recitation of the Kiddush at the beginning on a cup of wine. You're toasting the Shabbat, making special festive meals, dressing up a bit more nicely for the Shabbat. You know, you take a shower, whatever it would be. Meals, singing, Kiddush, Havdalah is also honoring the Shabbat. Right? That refers to what you might call the positive aspects. Shamar is the negative aspects. All of these different things you don't do on Shabbat. Okay? So, if a person makes Kiddush and sings and dances and eats and celebrates, he is fulfilling Zachor, but if he then writes and uses the phone and drives, he is violating Shamar. Conversely, if I sleep all day or I chain myself to my bed to be sure I don't do anything wrong on Shabbat, I have kept the Shamar, but I have not honored the Shabbat by celebration and by song and by eating and drinking and prayer. So a whole Shabbat comprises both the Zachor and the Shamar. Now, the Zachor of Shabbat, I think most of us understand, is a positive experience. It's the joy, it's the singing, it's the celebration, it's the camaraderie, it's the study of Torah, it's the singing of Zemirot. We will call that the fun part of Shabbat. The Shamar is sometimes a little more difficult for us to get a handle on. And that is, can't turn on a light, can't rip the toilet paper. That's a strange one for people. You know, the toilet paper has to be pre-ripped. What is all that about? Now, sometimes you'll hear people tell you, well, for example, why can't I turn on a light in Shabbat? So the standard answer that's given, although it's a much more complicated answer than you might think, is, well, since a current goes through a filament, now this is only an incandescent, fluorescents have different theories, but if you go with the old-fashioned, it's almost getting extinct, but the old-fashioned incandescent light bulb. I don't even know if you guys know what that is. I don't know if they make them anymore. But the original Edison light bulb, where you have an electrical current going through a filament generating heat, until it glows. So you will be told that is making a fire. The Torah says don't make a fire in Shabbat, so I can't make fires. So sometimes people say that doesn't make sense. In the olden days, making a fire was so much hard work. You had to rub two stones together, it took 2 hours. So the Torah says don't make fire. Now you're telling me when I can just flip a light switch, that's going to be a problem? Or I'll give you an example. Why can't it? There are 39 categories of work that you don't do on Shabbat. Writing, harvesting, planting, a lot of it is agricultural. So, let's take driving. Now, driving is not listed on the list. You're not going to open the Talmud and say, thou shalt not drive on Shabbat. there were no cars. So, obviously, if we prohibit driving, it's because in driving, there is an activity that is one of the 39 prohibited things. So, technically, driving is considered to be, because of the consumption of fuel that burns in an internal combustion engine, you are simply making a fire. You're burning fuel through heat. So imagine this. When I was in seventh grade, so my classmates were having bar mitzvahs. and many of them were not Shomer Shabbat. So they had the bar mitzvah in a synagogue, and it was around 5 miles from my house in the summer. So I was walking to this bar mitzvah, and one of my teachers drove by, he was not religious, and offered me a ride, and I said, can't take it. So I'm walking in the hot summer, and the teacher says, why can't you go in the car? So I say something like, well, I'm not allowed to do work on Shabbat, so I can't go in the car, so instead I'm going to walk 5 miles without water, by the way, because you're not allowed to carry unless there's what's called an Erev. Okay? So here's the thing, this kind of makes no sense. I can't go in a car because I'm not allowed to do work on Shabbat, so instead I'll walk 5 miles in the sun, which is not work on Shabbat. Well, by any definition of work, walking 5 miles in the sun is a lot more work than getting into a car. Answer? That maybe we are mistranslating a term. The word melacha, which is translated in every English translation as work, is not so much physical exertion. The Torah is not talking about physical exertion. The Torah is talking about creative mastery and domination over the natural forces of the universe. Melacha is not defined by how physically difficult something is. Melacha is defined by the creative mastery and domination you are asserting over the raw materials. Let me just list the melachot. So planting, harvesting, threshing, writing, the use of fire. These are not forbidden because they are physically hard. They are forbidden because they demonstrate mastery over the universe. Now, what is the idea? Shabbat celebrates God as the source of creation. So how do I acknowledge that God is the source of creation? By refraining from exercising my creativity within the world. And therefore, the notion that because it's easier to get a fire today, that should make it more permitted. If anything, that's a reason to make it more forbidden. Because if anything, our mastery is ever greater when the technology gives us these shortcuts. And therefore, Shabbat is a corrective to the hubris and arrogance of a human being. Because in truth, we are godlike. The Torah says we are made in the image of God. What does it mean to be in the image of God? Right, this famous verse. God does not have an image. God does not have a face. Right? God, one of the principles of Judaism, unlike Christianity, is, you know, God never assumes a human form. So the image of God is not a reference to physicality, but to qualities of God within us, such as intelligence, free will, creativity, autonomy. So we are godlike. We are creative. We have intellect. We are able to control much of our environment. We can create. We can destroy. Human beings are godlike in their capacity to manipulate reality and to control their environment. But that's a wonderful thing. Faith in God is not passive, meaning to say, we don't say, for example, oh, let's not drain the swamps because if God doesn't want malaria, he'll kill the mosquitoes. The Jewish faith in God is not quiescent or passive. The Jewish faith in God requires that we take initiative. And that's what we do. To fight injustice, to build civilization, to advance science. But the great danger in that is we become arrogant, we become smug, we think that we are the masters of the universe. So comes one day every week in which we refrain from exercising our technological mastery over our environment to acknowledge that God is the ultimate source of reality. So therefore, melacha is not so much about physical exertion as it is about mastery over my environment. and I refrain from doing that. So that is part of the package. Part of the Shabbat experience is to refrain from demonstrating that mastery, to show your humility and your submission to God as the source of creativity. Now, I will raise a question for you to think about. There is one form of creation, and it may be the highest form of creation of all, that not only is permitted on Shabbat, but is even encouraged on Shabbat, and that is the creation of human life. Because Shabbat is holy, and because the relationship of husband and wife is holy, Friday night is actually considered to be the optimal night for, you know, intimacy and potential procreation, even though you're creating a life together with God. So that's the one type of creativity that we do consider permitted. We also permit spiritual creativity, so to speak, creativity of the mind, but not translated into concrete action. So one idea of the refraining from all these activities is it's a lesson in modesty, humility, and limits. That I am not the master of the universe. That's lesson one. But there is a lesson two. If one lesson of Shabbat is, I am not the master of the universe, lesson two is, the universe is not my master. Only God is my master. Meaning, it's an amazing thing. All of us, when Shabbat comes, there's all sorts of stuff that we haven't finished yet. There are papers that are going to be due. There are deadlines that have to be met. And yet, when Shabbat comes, no matter what the demands are, you have the freedom to say, just, to quote Nancy Reagan in another context, just say no. That's remarkable. The world just stops knocking at my door. So on one hand, Shabbat teaches me I'm not the master of things. But it also teaches me they're not the, whoever they are, they're not the masters of things either. I have freedom. Many of you may have heard of Herman Welk, who is still alive. He's in his 90s. He's a great novelist. His novels have been turned into plays and movies. The Kay Mutiny, Marjorie Morningstar, The Winds of War. A very famous person. In fact, he's in his 90s. I think he just wrote a novel last year. So he can keep on going. He happens to be an Orthodox Jew. And he actually wrote a book about his relationship with Judaism called This Is My God. Quite a good book. He's a good writer, so it's written in a entertaining style. He tells the story that in the early 1950s, his first novel was being turned into a Broadway play. I think it was the Kane Mutiny. And they were working 18-hour shifts. And the play was finally going to open up on Broadway, not off-Broadway, on Broadway itself. It was going to open up on Broadway Saturday night. You can imagine, as you're getting closer and closer to opening night, the schedule is getting many, many, many more hours. So around Friday afternoon, 2 p.m., he tells his co-producer, I'll see you later. Now the co-producer figures he's going to the bathroom or getting a cup of coffee. He says, okay, but be back in 10 minutes. So Herman Welk said to him, I don't think you understand. I'm not going for 10 minutes. I'm going for 26 hours. I will be back a half an hour before opening tomorrow night. And the person looked at him. He couldn't even, he was speechless. Our play is opening up in 28 hours. And you are simply going to take off 26 out of those 28 hours? Or 26 and a half? You're back 27 and a half? You're back a half an hour before opening? And he looked at him as if he was absolutely insane. We are working 18-hour days around the clock here. And you're just going to leave? And Herman Welk said he must have been crazy. And he realized that although he had been keeping Shabbat all of his life, that made him realize, yeah, that's what Shabbat is. The world does not own you. You're not a slave. You're a slave to God, but you're not a slave to that boss. You're not a slave to your professor. You're not a slave to your classroom. You are a free person, and there's at least one day a week in which the world can make no demands on you. And that is why a second difference, I had mentioned one difference in Exodus and Deuteronomy, is Exodus says Zachor, Deuteronomy says Shamar. We talked about the difference. There's another difference. In Exodus, it connects Shabbat as a memorial that God created the world in 6 days and he rested on the seventh. In Deuteronomy it says, God gave you Shabbat so you shall remember you were a slave in Egypt and God redeemed you. So I would suggest to you that the structure is, these are two different understandings of Shabbat. One is a sense of humility, that I'm not the boss, God is the boss. The other is, I'm a free person, the world cannot make me a slave. And that's really important, because unless it's a matter of life and death, and indeed if it is a matter of life and death, Shabbat is violated. I shouldn't even call it a violation, it's a mitzvah to violate the Shabbat. But if it's not a matter of life and death, it can wait. And that's a very important lesson. And that is why part of the halachic obligation of Shabbat is that psychologically you should feel that all of your work is finished, although it's never finished. But you just put it out of your mind. That's why people ask questions. It's interesting shailas like this. Are you allowed to study for a test in Shabbat? It's an interesting question. Now, you're not allowed to write, you're not allowed to take notes, you're not allowed to, you know, push a digital recorder. You know, you can't do that. But let's say all I want to do is read a book. And I happen to want to read my classroom book, my textbook. Can I do that on Shabbat? So it's interesting. Technically, there's nothing wrong with it. But it's not really in the spirit, because you really should put that weekday activity behind you. Bottom line is, though, that if a person is such a nervous wreck that unless they study for their test, they're not going to be in a calm spirit of mind, so we do allow it then, because we want you to be calm for Shabbat. But ideally, you know, put it behind you. And that's an amazing thing. It's a very, very liberating thing. And it's been well said by a great thinker that more than the Jewish people have kept the Shabbat has kept the Jewish people. And I hope that you will find this treasure of Shabbat, and I hope, as I said, you will incorporate it into your lives to whatever degree you're able to do so, because it will certainly be a source of great, great blessing. All right, so Shabbat Shalom. We'll see you all later.